The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right, we're going to start today with an important song. This doubles as news, so pay attention. Here we go. Take it away, Mangy Fetlocks.
Howdy, folks. Brian Kemp, the governor of Georgia, signed a new voter suppression law into effect yesterday. Pretty proud, you know. He was able to become governor by purging the voter rolls of about 500,000 citizens. And now he's continuing that kind of proud racist tradition down there in Georgia. So a little song for him. Brian Kemp, Jim Crow, Brian Kemp. Jim Crow, Brian Kemp, Jim Crow, that's about all you need to know. Brian Kemp, Jim Crow, Brian Kemp, Jim Crow. Georgia chose to go back a century or so in fear that black and poor folks might be voting. Republicans in Georgia had a plan to make as hard as hell, but it's worth noting. To do so, they were counting on one man. Brian Kemp, Jim Crow, Brian Kemp, Jim Crow. Georgia stooped as low as a state could ever go. Brian Kemp, Jim Crow, Brian Kemp, Jim Crow. Kemp's not scared to go where the honorable won't go. Republicans were mad at Stacey Abrams. They felt the need to put her in her place. Making laws aimed at voter suppression, laws tailored just for one specific race. Brian Kemp, Jim Crow, Brian Kemp, Jim Crow. Georgia's racist show has now hit a new plateau. Brian Kemp, Jim Crow, Brian Kemp, Jim Crow. A new law apropos of a time long, long ago. Kemp knew to sign a law like this was shameful. He gathered nice white folks to see it done. Few would have been so bold as to bring back Jim Crow. But Brian Kemp has proved that he is one. Brian Kemp, Jim Crow, Brian Kemp, Jim Crow. Racists don't lay low down in Georgia anymore. Brian Kemp, Jim Crow, Brian Kemp, Jim Crow. Thought you all should know, Georgia's bringing back Jim Crow.
All right. You're welcome. Thank you. Mangy Fetlocks, everybody, also known as Bruce W. Nelson. Thanks. Welcome to the show. I'm Nicole Sandler. Sorry I wasn't here yesterday. I'm a little bit under the weather. Because I got the second Moderna vaccine on Wednesday. I was fine Wednesday. Wednesday night, middle of the night, got really sick. It continued. I'm much better today, but I'm not 100%. So today's going to be a little different than it otherwise would have been. If I was feeling okay, I'd be spending the first segment of this program talking about the sickening situation in Georgia and the heinous, vindictive Brian Kemp, Jim Crow, who's trying to keep you from voting because the Republicans lost in the last election. Or I'd be talking about Joe Biden's first press conference, how really good he was, and how lousy the questions were. And Caitlin Collins from CNN, what the fuck? Asking if Kamala Harris will be Biden's running mate in 2024? Really, that's the question you come up with at the first press conference? Get a clue. Or I'd be talking about the fact that the Florida legislature just passed what they call the anti-riot law, which means basically they can arrest you for protesting. Just know I've got a bunch of stuff on the list to deal with next week. But you hear me. I'm not fully here. My brain's not really working. And I do have a live interview coming up in the second half of the show. We're going to speak with Amanda L. Tyler. And she clerked for Ruth Bader Ginsburg and collaborated with her on RGB's last book, RBG's last book, which is called Justice, Justice, Thou Shalt Pursue. And so we will be talking to her live in about a half hour. So I'm going to rest my voice until then. And I'm going to share with you a charming interview that I did with the Marsh family. Now, you know about the Marsh family because I've played some of their songs. They're based in the UK and they're just absolutely adorable. So you'll hear, well, you'll hear them and you'll meet them. And we'll do it all right now. I think. Here we go. Oh, here we go. You know, throughout the whole pandemic, I have taken great pleasure in finding creative people like you guys who have turned the proverbial lemons into lemonade, taking this weird situation that we're all in and turning it into something really amazing. And I stumbled upon the Marsh family, and you guys are just awesome. So let's say hello. We got Ben and Danielle, and why don't you guys introduce the kids?
So right at the back there is Alfie, and he's 14. And on this end here, we have Tess, who's our youngest. She's 9. And then there's Thomas here, who's 13. And Ella in the middle, who's 11.
Wow. And friendly round is the dog, Monty, who we hope won't be too disruptive, but usually is when he can be.
Monty's awesome, and Monty has made some wonderful contributions to your songs.
That's true.
I love him. And I love that he's obviously part of the family. You have gotten a whole lot there. There he is. You've gotten a whole lot of fans around the world. When you first started doing these songs, did you have any idea it was going to turn into such a big thing?
No, definitely not.
No, we'd always done songs just ourselves and for friends and family, but we had absolutely no conception that there would be anyone else that was interested in them at all. Wow. So it's been lovely to find that they brought a few smiles to people all over the place. And actually getting messages back, you know, we really like it when people say they're in Canada or Florida or Australia or wherever it might be. Yeah. It makes us feel weirdly connected in a very disconnecting time.
Most definitely. I mean, one of the things that I did during this pandemic is I reached out. I did a segment called Quarantine Calling, where I would check in with people all around the world who were in the same situation. This is a very unique time in history, because while we've experienced some things, you know, in tandem, this, I believe, certainly the first time since I've been alive, that the whole world was dealing with the same issue and having to, you know, stay home. This was unprecedented. So I checked in with people from New Zealand to Germany to Australia to Finland and Denmark and all over. There's another woman, a woman named Shirley Sherman, who's been doing parody songs from New Zealand. I don't know if you've seen her stuff, but she's great. And she's actually a school principal in New Zealand who just during the quarantine started doing these song parodies, and she's quite brilliant. So you should check her stuff out too. There's a whole, it's like a cottage industry, but when I stumbled upon you guys, I fell in love. When I was watching, I watched a few of your videos, and Ben, I figured you and Danielle have to be professional musicians, and that's why your family is so musical, but that's not the case. You're a history professor.
That's right, yeah, I teach Atlantic Worlds and Early American History at the University of Kent. So, I mean, there are some professional musicians lurking around my family, so there's definitely music in my genes. My dad's a music teacher, my mum's a composer, so I'm a bit of a black sheep, but I do my performing through teaching and lecturing and shouting at the children, basically.
Yeah, and I'm a teacher by trade, but now work at the university looking after PhD students. Huh. So, but we met at university. And we had a sordid past in amateur dramatics while we were at university. So I think that's probably all come out, sadly, at this point in time.
Now, all the kids, you all, I mean, the whole family, you've got wonderful singing voices. I sing, you know, in the privacy of my own car or shower when nobody can hear me, because that's the best way. Tess, I mean, not to single you out, but oh, my goodness, you did have the new jab, the great take on Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah, and it brought me to tears. I mean, your voice is just so beautiful. Is this what you want to do with your life? Do you want to be a professional singer? Any of you?
Well, I've always liked singing, but personally, I've always wanted to be a vet when I grow up, and I've always loved animals.
Ah, I like that, too. That's so you keep your options open. And Ella, you too. You have wonderful voices. The harmonies are just spectacular. Does it come naturally to you, or do you have to work really hard at it?
Well, yeah, we do try and kind of, we do lessons with our Nana, Tess and I. So we do want to try and, but there's always room for improvement. But we always try and keep the element of fun in there as well.
And Thomas and Alfie, you guys all play instruments, too. I mean, some of the songs you do are done with, you know, a track. You sing to a track. But you've done a few videos where you've all picked up instruments and you're all playing. How long have you played? And what do you play?
Well, so I've been playing piano as my kind of main instrument since I started primary school. But I also kind of dabble in bass guitar, because I kind of picked that up at the start of lockdown because Dad pulled out of the attic and wasn't using it. And then he had it restrung, so I thought I'd have a go at that. So yeah, they're probably my main two. They're the ones that I contribute with normally in the songs.
I don't dabble in as many instruments as Alfie, but I play clarinet. I've played that for how long now?
About five years.
So yeah, I think Dad's plan overall was to kind of get quite a wide variety of instruments. He's got Ella on brass, me on woodwind, and Tess on strings and what. So it's been a plan all along to kind of build up our own orchestra.
Thomas actually had asthma when he was much younger, and so one of the things they recommended was a wind instrument to help breathing. So, and he's always had quite big doggy eyes, so it's a good look for him, the clarinet. And we wanted Ella to have something a bit punchy, didn't we? That wasn't too girly.
I like to play the tuba.
Yeah, she's tuba. About the tuba now, so you can go to the next level, I think.
But yeah, and then the drum kit was something that you all kind of you all get given a percussion instrument or get told to play along. Mm. I think that's kind of been the mentality, really. When we started the beginning of lockdown, we realised we were going to need to do something to occupy ourselves, and it was something that we've always enjoyed doing together. It was done initially as a kind of a birthday present for grandparents who we weren't going to see, and then it got a little bit bigger than that. And it's been quite nice not to focus on the fact that we're being watched across the world, but it's quite nice to know that we're doing it for something other than ourselves, and that people do seem to be getting a bit of joy out of it. Whether it's the arguments at the beginning of the videos, that's going to resonate quite a lot.
Well, it's not only the arguments at the beginning of the videos. You just released last week a reel, like a 20-minute long reel of outtakes, which is just charming. As much as we loved you guys already, this just brings it even more full circle. You guys are just adorable. It's so cute. Now, you released that in conjunction or right around the same time you actually made your first. Was this your first television appearance at the Red Nose Day event? What was this? What happened there?
Yeah, so we did. It was our first proper live performance out of the house. It was the first time we've been out of the house in an awfully long time. Yeah, we were contacted back in February by the organisers of Comic Relief and asked if we would be able to do it. And we didn't want to say no. It's such a fabulous charity. So, yeah, we gathered together all of our nerves, and last Friday we went and actually filmed in a studio, and it was shown live on television, so it was quite strange and surreal for us all.
Right, and you raised a lot of money, too.
Yeah, the whole charity obviously raised a phenomenal amount, but we put just a little Just Giving site, and we've been putting any money that we've been raising from our songs onto it. Yeah, I think we're at nearly £13,000 now, so that's just phenomenal. And from across the world, which has been so lovely.
It's a fabulous charity. It's once every 2 years, and it mixes sort of comedy and humour, so often involves UK comedians doing sketches, making fools of themselves. So it was entirely appropriate that we were there in our pyjamas. Yeah. And, you know, it was a really nice one to do, because even if it went wrong, we didn't cope very well with it. It was we knew they were going to be incredibly supportive. Happily, I think for us as parents, knowing that we were kind of stressing about how the kids were doing, so we didn't really have time to feel nervous. It was only when the lights went on and we realised we're in a proper massive studio and we'd not been there before. But these guys were great. They nailed it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, kids, how did you like it? Did you get the bug? You enjoy it?
I-
I personally, I loved it. I love the experience of kind of getting up early. I don't normally, but with that kind of excitement, it almost felt, since we've been at home for so long, it had a kind of holiday-esque feel, and kind of just going somewhere other than our house. And then when we actually got onto the stage, and it was just kind of an adrenaline rush that you get, and then you enjoy doing it, but then, like, after the tape, you always find yourself with your hand shaking slightly. It's always that kind of thing where there's always that kind of fear at the back of your mind, but it's just a wonderful experience overall.
What was the best bit?
Well, it was when we first walked into the kind of actual stage bit with all of the kind of LED spotlights and stuff. It was just really cool to see all of the stuff in there.
We didn't insist on, you know, kind of runners and riders, but there was a lovely team there helping. And when Tess realised that there were as many cups of tea as she wanted were available, Tess partook of the cups of tea, didn't you? So we missed a couple of bits because we had to dash to the loo once we go. But it was good fun.
Now, were there famous people running around, or was it kept separate because of the COVID?
Well, it was obviously very COVID separate, so we could see on the dressing rooms around us all the famous people who were going to be occupying them, and there were a few singers there at the time that we recognised, and we kind of smiled out from afar. But from our point of view, from my point of view, Richard Curtis and Emma Freud, who are the two people. Richard Curtis is the director of, like, Notting Hill and For Wedding and Funeral. It's his charity. He set up Comet Relief 35 years ago, and they came to watch us record. So that was our moment of kind of, oh my goodness, this is actually real, and this is quite big,
right?
So it was a phenomenal thing to be a part of, and we were really just really treated wonderfully, so that was really, really nice.
That's great to hear. I love that they invited you. Yeah, we have Comic Relief over here. You know, for years it was Billy Crystal, Whoopi Goldberg, and Robin Williams, and it was mostly for homeless charities here. We also have Red Nose Day, but it's a whole different thing. I don't think it's in conjunction. It's a promotion through, I think, Walgreens pharmacies. But you know, similar names for fundraising events. Yours sounds wonderful. I went looking for a video, hoping I could see your performance, and it's not, first of all, the whole event is not available here in the States. It's only available in the UK right now. So hopefully they will release, because they've released bits of the show from, you know, different people, but yours wasn't there. However, somebody did shoot video, I guess, watching you guys on the television. So it's not a great recording of it, but I did get to see you, and you nailed it. So
standing in our pajamas, yes, it was one of the strangest things we've done.
Now, those weren't your pajamas. They actually supplied new pajamas for you?
We got to bring them home. We got to keep them. That was the most exciting parts of the whole day. New pajamas.
So the song that you performed was the Totally Stuck Where We Are. Tell us, so how do you pick what songs you're going to do, and who writes the new lyrics? How did these come about?
Well, there's always a few floating around. There's always music on, and people are plugged into different rooms, into different things. But usually there's three or four that we're kind of thinking about doing. And actually, this was it's obviously the Jim Steinman, Bonnie Tyler, 1983 original, Total Eclipse of the Heart.
Right.
I think, sadly, we've kind of infected the kids with 80s classics and old musicals, like the One Day More one that we did originally that sort of went viral. I usually have a first stab at rewriting some of the words. And that was just a perfect fit for us, because there's so many lines that overlap with one another, and they're quite short, and there's lots that you can do to sort of play with them. So I then kind of produce the words, and then there's a massive argument and people refuse to sing them, and I either get grumpy and go back to the bedroom or the office or something, or someone says, I'm up for that, Dad, and we kind of, the negotiations begin.
Normally it's about, we'll listen to a song, and then one of us will say, well, this could work, and if you get one particular line, and I think for Ben, he realised a couple of lines might be good for a parody with that one. But sometimes it's just about getting different voices, because a song that's sung by an individual is quite hard to divide between all of us. So we've had a few that we've tried and they've not quite worked, or we haven't quite felt it was the moment to release them. But most of the time, once we get to the point where Ben's written some lyrics, we give it a go. And yeah, some of them seem to really catch on. And I think particularly that one was the first one we'd done in a while that was about just the small things that really wind you up, like the print suddenly running out of ink, or things that parents particularly could really get a hang, you know, could feel like doors not being shut and lights always being left on. And I think when we focus on things that are irritating to us, they seem to strike a chord across the world, whether it's Australia or Israel or Germany. The parents seem to be having the same issues, and the children seem to be having the same moans as well. So, but that one really did seem to take hold.
Oh, it was. Uh-oh. Okay, somehow my recording got messed up. Whoa. Shoot. Hold on. Ah! All right. Hold on. Damn it. Best laid plans and all that. Somehow. Oh, and that's the wrong picture, too. Somehow my recording got messed up. What I was going to play for you there, I'm just going to have to play the song manually, is this one. Sorry, I was going to play the song that they performed at the thing. I don't know how my recording got screwed up, but it did. So let me just play it for you manually, and we'll do it like that. Boy, talk about flying by the seat of our pants today. All right, so here we are. It is the Marsh Family, Totally Fixed Where We Are. All right, let's do this and do this. And here is the song.
Song.
I think.
Third lockdown.
2021, and it's a little bit lonely. No one's ever coming round.
Third lockdown.
2021, we bet we'd all be outside, but I'm still listening to the sound of the tears.
Third lockdown.
Every day I'm treated like I offer room service, but they mess it in the blink of an eye.
We'll be right back.
Nothing we can say, we're totally fixed where we are.
We're totally fixed where we are.
We're totally fixed where we are.
Lord of the flies.
They're just too cute.
Kill the pig, cut his throat, spill his blood, do it again!
Thank you, everybody. Good night. We're here all week.
Okay, how adorable are they? So I'm sorry that the interview got screwed up. I will post the whole interview on the blog today with the rest of the show. Because it got cut off. I thought what we'd do here, we've got a couple of minutes before our guest comes up. There's one more song I want to play for you by them. It's not one of their best known ones. And they're the Marsh Family. That's who that is. And you can find them at Marsh Songs, MarshFamilySongs.com. Gives you links to their YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, everything, and wherever they have posted the songs posted everywhere. You should check them out. But I want to play one more. They don't get very political. Except this one was from last June, and it was right during the whole Black Lives Matter stuff, right? And it's their take on Amazing Grace. And when I say it's amazing, I mean it's amazing. So here they are one more time, the Marsh Family with their rendition of, oops, that's the wrong one, with their rendition of Amazing Grace. The slave trader, Edward Colt, a slave trader in England, a statue was toppled. Showing on the screen now are statues of, I guess, racists in the UK and statues that have been brought down there and the hashtag Black Lives Matter. So for a family who's in the UK who in these songs does not get very political. How brilliant was that? Just absolutely incredible. So, yeah, wow. I don't know what to even say after that. I mean, I wish I could play for you the rest of the interview. Just, I don't know what happened to my, you have no idea. Again, it's part of, I am dealing with the aftermath of the second Moderna vaccine dose. So I, you know, feeling a lot better now, but honestly not, certainly not at 100%. So if you get, when you get your vaccine, let me tell you right now that be prepared. And if you can schedule them for a Friday, so you have the weekend to deal with it, that's not a bad idea. As it is, I had to take off yesterday. Today, I'm on the mend, but I'm far from 100%. And, you know, working on getting better. So, but I'll tell you, it certainly beats the alternative. I would take my 24 to 48 hours of chills and fever and just overall feeling lousy over, you know, COVID any day of the week. So don't let my tale of a, you know, a bad reaction to the shot dissuade you. You still need to get it. And like I said, yeah, you know, it's a day of feeling lousy, but it passes. And the alternative is so much worse. I just, after going through what I went through for the last couple of days, for the last day, I can't even imagine what it's like getting full blown COVID. I don't even want to think about it. I was that miserable yesterday. So thanks for bearing with me today. Our guest is on the line. I'm just trying to get our shot together and then I'll bring in Professor Amanda L. Tyler. Let me tell you about Professor Tyler. She is a law professor, at UC Berkeley. And before she went into academia, she actually clerked for Justice, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Amanda, thank you. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So the occasion is the publication of a new book, which happens to be the final project from Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. It's called Justice, Justice Thou Shalt Pursue, A Life's Work Fighting for a More Perfect Union. And you worked with her on this for what, the last few months of her life?
Yes.
So tell us about your relationship with her. I mean, I feel like I can call her Ruth because, you know, we just did this whole family thing. I feel like, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was everyone's grandmother. She was that person who just did so much good for the nation. You had a close relationship with us. So tell us about your relationship and how you worked with her.
I called her the justice.
The justice, as did all her clerks, right? Everybody yes. referred to her as the justice.
The justice. And I clerked for her in 1999. I started in 1999 and I clerked for her for a year. Typically a Supreme Court clerkship is just that. It's a year in length. And it was an experience that changed my life. I mean, I can talk at great length, I'll respond to your prompts, but about all that she taught me in that year and in the year since. What has been a really special privilege in my life has been being able to work with her again 20 years later on this book project, and to see it now finally in print is just really special.
It's got to be. And the book is wonderful. And what it includes are a couple of, well, kind of interviews. The one you did with her that prompted the story. Why don't you talk about that and how this came about?
Yes. So I invited the justice to come to UC Berkeley to do an event in honor of a woman named Herma Hill Kay. Now, Herma Hill Kay had been her friend for some 50 years by that point, and had unfortunately passed away in 2017. The justice, I like to say that when I would invite her to do things, I was never confident that I would get a yes, but I knew I would get one with this because I knew she would want to come and honor Herma. Their connection goes back to the 60s, and in the early 70s, together with a third co-author, they wrote the very first case book on gender discrimination in the law. So that's the genesis of the friendship. They were part of really creating this field and launching Justice Ginsburg's advocacy career. And so the justice agreed to come, and she was originally supposed to come in January of 2019, but we had to delay it because in December of 2018, doctors discovered lung cancer and she had to have surgery on her left lung. She actually resisted postponing the event because it was so important to her to come and honor Herma. That's how loyal she was. But she did eventually agree, and wisely so, and we postponed and rescheduled right away for the fall. So she came in October of 2019. And she said from the outset she didn't want to give prepared remarks. She'd rather have a conversation. And I was only too happy to oblige. And so what we did is we planned going back and forth, talking about, you know, we planned the questions. Mm-hmm. We didn't get to all of them. I would have loved to have had more time with her. But the conversation covers the arc of her life. It starts with her childhood and it concludes with her time on the Supreme Court and what work she thinks is left to be done. So we tried to cover quite a lot of ground. And then the book came out of that actually in large measure because of Herma Hill Kay. So we knew that the University of California Press was considering publishing Kay's last work, which was a book about the first American women law professors.
Right.
And Justice Ginsburg had written the introduction for that, and it was really important to her to see that book published. So we decided that we would offer the press the carrot of creating a book out of our conversation about Justice Ginsburg, but our condition was they had to release the books together. And I'm very happy to say that this spring, both books, our book and Paving the Way by Herma Hill Kay, are releasing alongside one another.
Yes, and that's awesome. And her collaborator Patricia, and I'm not at 100% right now. I forget her last name, but Patricia, who is Kane, is going to come on this show as well to talk about that book because it sounds fascinating.
That's great.
So we just have to get scheduled, but we're gonna do that. So this book, called Justice Thou Shalt Pursue, contains your conversation, a transcript of it. It also has Ruth Bader Ginsburg's intro or a tribute to Herma Hill Kay. Is that the intro to the book, or is that something different?
So I wrote an introduction to the book that comes before the tribute to Herma Hill Kay.
Right.
But a similar version of that tribute is the introduction to Herma's book.
Right. That's what I figured. And then the rest of the book is a collection of the justices' opinions, arguments, interviews, and speeches that she personally selected because she said she thought these best captured her legacy.
Yes, I think it's fair to say that the book is a compilation of things for which she hoped to be remembered. So we have in there, for example, the very first brief that she ever filed in a gender discrimination suit. The very first case was a case called Moritz. And what's so special about that is, among other things, the brief has never been published before. Mm. It lays out the roadmap for the work that she's going to do in the 1970s. And it was a special case to her, because she litigated it with her husband. They did this together. Aww. And they won the case. And the case also was special to her. And she talks about this in our conversation because the law was changed. It was a discriminatory tax law that actually singled out men who had never been married for exclusion from a benefit. They won in the 10th Circuit, the appellate court below the Supreme Court, in arguing that this was an unfair discrimination and an unconstitutional discrimination. The government sought cert or review in the Supreme Court when that happened. But in the meantime, the law was changed. So the Supreme Court never heard the case because there was no reason to. The law had been changed. But the key to all of this is that the government, in seeking review in that case, listed in its brief in an appendix every single statute in the United States Code that distinguished between the genders.
Wow.
And as Justice Ginsburg explains, you know, this is before personal computers. Compiling this with a team of researchers would take a very long time, and the government did it for her. And so she said of this list, it was a pearl beyond price. There it was for us, a roadmap for what we needed to do. And they set to work.
So I got to ask, did you meet Marty Ginsburg? Did you get to know him at all?
Yes, I clerked for her when Marty was still alive, and that was a love affair for the ages.
It sounds that way.
It was, and it comes across, I think, when she talks about him in the book. And I will tell you, as I mentioned, I wrote the introduction to the book, but Justice Ginsburg, being who she was, she of course wanted to look it over and edit it, and I was only too happy to have her do that because she was a truly great writer, and she just gave amazing feedback. One of the things that she said when she read the draft introduction was that we needed more Marty in it, and I just love that. This last summer, she was very much still thinking about Marty, and we were very much going to include him and celebrate him because he was a huge part of her story. As she told many of her clerks, her marriage and her family were the most important things in her life. And as she talks about in the book, he was her biggest booster. He was her biggest supporter. And she never would have accomplished all that she did if she didn't have a true partner in life.
I get goosebumps thinking about it. And we've seen, thankfully, there's been a number of documentaries about her life. There's been a theatrical film released, A Matter of Sex, which was about her life. And so we got to know the story. Even if you maybe have not read a biography of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, we know the basics, and the love story between her and Marty certainly comes across. And I'm glad to know it's every bit as romantic as it sounded. So that was her first brief that she worked on with her husband. Then you also have her first oral argument, which obviously is before she was on the Supreme Court, Frontiero versus Richardson, and then Weinberger versus Weisenfeld. What was special about those two?
She singles those out as her favorite oral arguments of all the ones that she did. I think in part because Frontier was the very first time she appeared before the Supreme Court. Yeah. And as we discussed, she talked uninterrupted for some 10 or 11 minutes in that case, which is unheard of. And so she talks in our conversation about how she wasn't sure whether the justices, were listening to her. So she decides to invoke Sarah Grimke's show-stopping line that all we ask is that men take their feet off of our necks. She had to make sure they were listening and paying attention. And then Weisenfeld, I think that was her favorite case of all the cases that she handled. It was a case that involved a father who tragically lost his wife in childbirth, and he wanted to stay home with his son until his son went to school. And when he went to apply for Social Security benefits, he was told as a man he didn't qualify. Whereas if the tables had been turned, his wife would have been able to collect benefits. And I think what she loved about this case was that it was emblematic of what she liked to say about gender equality. She was very common to say that women will never achieve true equality until men share in the familial duties in raising children, for example. And here was a man, Stephen Weisenfeld, who wanted to do just that. And so I think she felt a special connection to the case that certainly comes across in our conversation in the book. And I think she also loved that it was a case that illustrated very powerfully how laws that are drawn along distinctions about gender don't just hold women back. They also hold men back, and it may hold everyone back from being able to chart their own destinies and make their own decisions about what they will find fulfillment in their lives.
When you get to the next section is Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Associate Justice, Supreme Court of the United States, and in comes Herma Hill Kay again, because you have her prepared statement on the nomination of Ruth Bader Ginsburg to the court. So it shows their close relationship throughout all those years. The interesting thing, and I kind of figured this would be the case, the decisions, the opinions that she publishes, I mean, one is a majority opinion that was in the United States versus Virginia, which had to do with Virginia Military Academy and allowing women in, right? But the other three were all dissents. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg was known as the great dissenter. She was known for her dissents. And the cases are the Lilly Ledbetter case, Shelby County, and Burwell versus Hobby Lobby. Those, I mean, people who are now currently paying attention should remember all three of those, which are still not, again, she wrote the dissent, so it means they weren't decided the way we would have liked to see them decided. But she's proud of these dissents, as are we. But these cases were special to her.
Yes, I think it's unfortunate that there are so many dissents, but that was her way, I think, of highlighting that there's still a lot of work to be done. She did not like to lose. Nobody likes to lose, but she really didn't. And she felt very passionately that those cases had been decided incorrectly. She read her dissents from the bench, as you'll see, you know, and we have there in the book, her statements. That's not a common thing to read a dissent from the bench. But she said in the Shelby County dissent, which it could not be more timely today, in fact, that she thought the majority was erring egregiously, not just erring, but erring egregiously.
So
that's a case. Sorry, go on.
No, I was going to say. So Shelby County is the case that did away with the protections under the Voting Rights Act, the pre-clearance requirement. So, for instance, a state like Georgia, because they've had I should let you explain it. You're the lawyer. I'm the novice. Why don't you tell us what Shelby County did?
Yes, well, Georgia is a jurisdiction that was covered under the Voting Rights Act of 1965's pre-clearance requirements.
Right.
And what that meant was under Sections 4 and 5 of the Act, because of its past history of racial discrimination in voting, the state had to pre-clear, that is to say, get authorization before any changes to its voting laws went into effect, from either the Department of Justice or a special panel of federal judges. That's all gone after Shelby County in 2013, when the court 5-4 strikes down the preclearance provisions as exceeding Congress's authority under the 15th Amendment. And Justice Ginsburg writes a dissent that, you know, you mentioned that she's known as the great dissenter. It's actually another justice, Harlan, is known as the great dissenter, but I think in time, think in time, Justice Ginsburg will be enjoying that same famous label, and primarily for that dissent, because I think what we're seeing play out is underscoring just how important the continuing enforcement of all aspects of the Voting Rights Act is. And in other words, just how right she was in her dissent.
Right. And what happened yesterday is just astounding. I know there have been legal challenges already filed. Do you think that this is going to hold up in court, what they're doing?
Well, the difference is now they'll be challenging the provisions outright as violating the Voting Rights Act, whereas before they never could have gone into effect until receiving authorization from, as I said, a panel of judges or the Department of Justice. But now we've jettisoned that framework, and so everything is going to play out in court, and it will depend on what the Supreme Court thinks about the underlying merits of what we have, and whether the law that's been enacted will have the effect of discriminating based on race and making it harder for minority voters to vote. And you know, there are a lot of indications that that's going to be the case. We'll see what the courts do. I wouldn't be surprised if this wound up ultimately in front of the Supreme Court.
Right. And therein lies the rub, as they say. The Supreme Court today is a 6-3 conservative majority. Shouldn't be this way on so many levels. First of all, Barack Obama should have been able to, nominate Merrick Garland, who should have had a hearing and should have been confirmed. We saw the Republicans hold that up for almost a year and say no after Justice Scalia died. Sorry, it's an election year. We have to let the people decide. And that gave us was it Brett Kavanaugh who came first,
or
Neil Gorsuch, right? Then Kennedy retires. I believe under questionable circumstances. We still don't know the story. And then we got Brett Kavanaugh, which was sort of an abomination of a hearing. Then Ruth Bader Ginsburg dies, and I got to tell you, I still remember the moment we were eating dinner. And the TV, we always have the news playing in the background, and they came on with the bulletin, and the minute I heard her name, I just knew, and they said, Ruth Bader Ginsburg has died, and I just, I dropped my fork and I'm just like, oh no, on so many levels, it was devastating. First of all, we lost one of the great Americans in history, one of my idols, one of the protectors of everything that's good. We lost her. And then it was, oh my God, Donald Trump is going to fill that seat, even though it was just, you know, weeks away from the election. Ruth Bader Ginsburg said that her family said her last wish was that they, you know, let the winner of the election choose her successor. And that's not what happened. I know you can't speak for her, but what must she have been thinking? What would she have thought? And then knowing the to add insult to injury, they put in Amy Coney Barrett in her seat. I'm just apoplectic over it. I'm still angry, as you can probably tell. I can't even imagine what she would have thought and what her family feels.
You're right. I can't speak for her and I can't speak for her family. What I can say is that she was fighting really hard to stay with us. And she was, I had the privilege of knowing her for a long time, and she had cancer for the first time the year I clerked for her. Mm. And what I saw was nothing short of heroic then. And I saw the same determination and grit and desire to keep serving as recently as last summer. So it is very, very unfortunate that she was not able to hold on and to have a proper retirement where she could be celebrated and she could relax. She was working right up until the end. She was serving right up until the end. And maybe that's fitting because it was central to who she was, serving and fighting for the things she believed in. But I do really wish that she'd been able to have a proper retirement and been able to be, particularly in the moment when she did pass, be fully celebrated and not have that moment mired in so many political aspects. And so, you know, I will say one of the things that I hope this book does with its release this spring is to sort of relaunch that celebration of her life and her legacy. And particularly as she laid it out, and as I said, I think the choice of including dissents and the choice of all the content was really for her to highlight the work that she hopes will continue even after her death.
And I'll let this go after this. I live in the land of woulda, shoulda, coulda. I mean, I think of how, you know, all the things I did wrong that I would have done differently if I had the knowledge that I have now. Should she have retired on her own before Donald Trump got elected?
That's hard to say. It's hard to predict, I think, how an election is going to go. We've had two very close elections, the last two. What I can say is what she said at the time, she was full steam. Mm-hmm. She loved her job. She really loved being a public servant. She loved, in particular, being a judge. She told all of her clerks that. And she took, you know, great fulfillment from using her talents to try and better our society. And that's someone, you know, when you're built that way, it's hard to walk away. And I think she felt like she was still at full steam. She said this. She still took great joy in the job. She really hit her stride in terms of the power and you know, sort of volume of her voice in those dissents that we see in the later years of her tenure. So I think it would have been really hard to walk away.
Yeah.
You know, hindsight is 20/20.
Yes, exactly. Well, yes, it is. There's just it. You know, I'm glad we had her for so long. I hate that it ended the way it did. And so let's get to the ending of the book, because it ends with an afterword that you wrote in October of 2020. And the first line of it, you wrote, "This part of the book was not supposed to exist." And so this is a part that she couldn't edit of what you wrote because you wrote it after she died. So how do you sum up the life of somebody like Ruth Bader Ginsburg?
You know, I borrowed a phrase from Justice Sotomayor to do that. Justice Sotomayor said it better than I could. She said that Justice Ginsburg was an American hero. And I certainly agree. She she was something really special. I think she's one of, and I think you've said this earlier, one of the greatest Americans ever to have lived.
I agree.
Hers was a life of service. Hers was a life in which you can say she left the world better than she found it. And so, so many of us, all of us really, are the beneficiaries of her dedication and her determination to contribute.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that it was really hard to write that. It was, I don't know if it comes across, but it was an incredibly emotional thing to try and write an afterword, knowing even just, you know, the little thing, as you said, that she wouldn't edit it. Right. She would not have liked to have something coming out that she didn't mark up. and I could have, I'm sure I could have used her editing skills because she was a phenomenal writer, but it was just really hard to do that in the immediate wake of her passing and to try and, as you say, summarize who she was and what she meant to me, but more importantly, what she meant to the country. And to do so at a time that was mired in a lot of politics and a lot of people having a lot of concerns about the continuing relevance and resonance of her legacy. So against all of that, though, I tried to write a hopeful afterword, and I borrowed words of hers, borrowed from Dr. King, about how the arc of the moral universe is long and it bends towards mm-hmm. justice. And I think she really believed that. And one of the things that we hoped for the book was that it would inspire people to pick up the mantle and keep that work going.
And the title of the book, Justice, Justice, Thou Shalt Pursue, is something that hung in her chambers? Tell us about where that comes from.
Yeah, so it's a beautiful phrase that's from Deuteronomy. Hmm. And she had a piece of artwork that hung on the wall of her chambers with the phrase, justice, justice, thou shalt pursue. And so when we were thinking about titles, I kept coming back to that because I've always associated that with her. That's who she was. She was all about pursuing justice, whether as an advocate or as a judge. It was sort of the overarching principle that animated everything that she did. And so it seemed only fitting to put it in the title alongside a reference to her life's work, fighting for a more perfect union. And in the book, you see this constant theme of this more perfect union. It is a phrase that is in the preamble to the Constitution, that we are constituting ourselves in order to build a more perfect union. And as she was very common to say, that work is ongoing. And even in the last piece of the book, before you get to the afterword, there is an absolutely beautiful speech that she gives at a naturalization ceremony. Mm. And she talks about the promise of America. She talks about how special it is that the child of an immigrant could sit on the Supreme Court. And then she calls on all the newest citizens to join her in working for that more perfect union. And that, too, is something that I think pervaded all that she did and all that she was. And so that, too, had a spot for, you know, we wanted to put that in the title as well.
Right. Yeah, that's what I neglected to go through after the decisions, the opinions that you published. There were three speeches at the end. First was Lessons Learned from Louis D. Brandeis, then remarks at the Genesis Foundation Lifetime Achievement Award Ceremony, and finally remarks at a naturalization ceremony. And then it's your afterword. It's a beautiful book, and it's a wonderful tribute to an amazing woman. So thank you for doing this with her. It's a great gift to us. I have an advance, a galley of it. So mine is not the completed copy. And I understand in the final edition, there are a lot of photos, too. So I'll have to go and check that one out because I don't have the pictures in here.
We need to make sure you get a proper book because the images are so special. And there, too, I added a few things after her passing. And there's one picture in particular that I just love, and I think she would have loved. It's a picture of a little girl who came to pay respects when the justice was lying in repose. And the little girl is in a Supergirl outfit, and she's saluting the justice.
Oh, my.
And that, just to me, that's what this is all about. It's about preserving the justice's legacy and making sure that future generations know about it and are inspired by it.
That's awesome. Amanda L. Tyler, the book is called Justice, Justice Thou Shalt Pursue. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today and for doing this. What a wonderful project and what a great legacy for an amazing woman. Really appreciate you coming on today. All right. You take
care. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Thank you. And with that, we're done. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'm going to recover and come back next week feeling much better with a clearer head and, you know, and immune from the COVID. All right. I'll see you Monday. Thanks again, everyone. Have a great weekend. Bye. Oh, don't leave yet. I did a What's News today, so at least I can tell you what's going on in the world. Here we go.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Are you worried that if you don't manage to pass voting rights legislation, that your party is going to lose seats and possibly lose control of the House and the Senate in 2022?
What I'm worried about is how un-American this whole initiative is. It's sick. It's sick. Deciding in some states that you cannot bring water to people standing in line waiting to vote. Deciding that you're going to end voting at 5 o'clock when working people are just getting off work. Deciding that there will be no absentee ballots under the most rigid circumstances. It's all designed, and I'm going to spend my time doing three things. One, trying to figure out how to pass the legislation passed by the House, number one. Number two, educating the American public. The Republican voters I know find this despicable. Republican voters, the folks out in the outside this White House. I'm not talking about the elected officials. I'm talking about voters. Voters. And so I'm convinced that we'll be able to stop this because it is the most pernicious thing. This makes Jim Crow look like Jim Eagle. I mean, this is gigantic what they're trying to do. And it cannot be sustained. I do everything in my power, along with my friends in the House and the Senate, to keep that from becoming the law.
That was President Joe Biden at his first press conference since taking office with his take on the voter suppression laws making their way through over 40 state legislatures since the November elections. And it was just hours before Georgia Governor Brian Kemp signed a Republican-sponsored bill passed just hours earlier through the Georgia House and Senate that restricts voting by mail and reforms elections in numerous ways, all in response to their losses in the 2020 elections. The bill will require a photo ID to vote absentee by mail, cut the time voters have to request an absentee ballot, limit where the ballot drop boxes can be placed. It also reduces the runoff election period from 9 weeks to 4, empowers state officials to take over local elections boards, and makes it a crime to approach voters in line to give them food and water. Wow. This new legislation would replace Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, who stood up to the former guy's attempts to overturn Georgia's election results as chair of the state election board, giving the job instead to a legislature appointee. Voting rights groups have said the bill will disenfranchise voters of color. Just stunning. And while Kemp was signing the bill, Georgia state legislator Park Cannon knocked on his office door so she could witness the bill signing. Instead, she was handcuffed, arrested, and removed from the state capitol in which she works. Video of the incident shows Representative Cannon knocking on the door to Kemp's office when an officer approaches her and tells her, "You're under arrest." Then two officers can be seen dragging her through the state capitol into an elevator, then out of the building as Cannon shouts, "Why am I under arrest? There's no reason for me to be arrested. I'm a legislator. Don't touch me." Later, Cannon confirmed on Twitter she'd been released from jail, saying, quote, "I am not the first Georgian to be arrested for fighting voter suppression."
Georgia's Department of Public Safety told the Washington Post that Cannon was arrested for obstructing law enforcement. Huh? So, President Biden did hold his first solo news conference as president, lasting just over an hour on Thursday afternoon. He said that his new target for coronavirus vaccinations is 200 million in his first 100 days in office, doubling the original target that his administration surpassed weeks ahead of schedule. Biden said that he had been focusing on fighting the spread of the coronavirus and providing economic relief, but he's now adding a few other priorities, including immigration reform, gun control, and protecting and expanding voting rights. Biden touched on a broad range of topics, signaling support for reforming the filibuster to curb what he described as decades of abuse, and he also confirmed that he does intend to run for re-election in 2024. When discussing immigration, Biden downplayed what's happening at the southern border and said the policies of his predecessor have made it harder to house and properly process the record number of migrant children in custody. On the international front, Biden said one of his main priorities is repairing global relationships. He also identified the top foreign policy issue he's facing right now as North Korea. Well, the U.S. has now surpassed 30 million total infections in the pandemic. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky again warned that despite reopenings and a growing desire to get back to normal, the U.S. is still seeing about 1,000 deaths a day and is facing the growing threat of coronavirus variants. She also said vaccination efforts are helping the situation. The Biden administration says it will dedicate another $10 billion to expand vaccine access and boost vaccine confidence. The Senate voted to extend the application deadline for the PPP program, the key federal relief effort for small businesses, to May 31st. And more promising news, this one for new moms, new research shows that the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are effective in pregnant and lactating women who then pass the protective antibodies to their newborns. And finally, New York officials on Thursday finalized a deal to legalize recreational marijuana in the state. If the legislature passes the bill and Governor Cuomo signs it, the law will make it possible to establish a $4.2 billion industry that could create tens of thousands of jobs, while potentially ending years of drug policing that resulted in a disproportionate number of arrests of Black and Latino suspects. The agreement between lawmakers and Cuomo calls for legalizing cannabis for adults 21 and older. It would allow for cannabis delivery and club-like lounges where marijuana, but not alcohol, could be consumed. Individuals would be allowed to grow up to 6 plants at home. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.